Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. My name is Rob Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and this is a bit of a rewind here because we are off for this week. This episode originally aired on January 8th, 2021, and it's about the movie Dr. X.
Yeah, this one was a lot of fun. This one was a film that I had never seen before, so it was all new to me. And it is, especially for, 1932? This is a very weird film. This one's a lot of fun. So it's a great one to feature once more as a rare Weird House Cinema rerun.
It's time to rub the synthetic flesh.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. My name's Rob Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and today I think we're going to be doing the chronologically earliest film that we've done so far, isn't that right?
I believe so.
So today we're going to be talking about Dr. X, a 1932 American pre-code horror film that shocked my soul and conscience, and I thought was just a fabulous ride.
Yeah. This one was a pleasant surprise for me as well. I was only vaguely aware of it. I'll get into some of that in a bit, but I was vaguely aware that it existed, knew basically nothing about it. You suggested it. I saw a couple of the people that were involved in it, and I just signed on sight unseen and went in without any spoilers or anything. Watched it this morning, and it was fabulous. So while it might seem to start out as a rather traditional film, and it ends fairly traditionally as well, it gets just heavily weird in the middle in a way that really has to be experienced.
Yeah. Well, there's one scene in particular. I mean, I would say that there is a like 5-minute sequence in this movie that you should watch the movie for, even if for nothing else. But there's some other mm-hmm. fun stuff in there as well.
Absolutely.
And we'll get into what that is later on. But I thought at first we should talk for a little bit about the historical context of this era of movies. So this is a pre-code movie. You might have heard that term used by film historians before, pre-code. And that code there refers to something called the Hays Code. So basically from about 1934 until roughly the end of the 1950s, I think sometimes the movie Some Like It Hot in 1959 is
is held out as sort of like the demise of the Hays Code era. But for this period, from the mid-30s through the 50s, American film studios sort of agreed to be governed by censorship guidelines that were known as the Hays Code. So this prohibited a lot of stuff that you might, you know, automatically think of course, obvious R-rated content like nudity and profanity, but it also banned content that was considered objectionable to conservative social values. So that might be all kinds of, you know, references to cannibalism and things. Mm-hmm. You weren't supposed to have movies in which the audience would be asked to sympathize with criminals or crime, which is just a great guideline for complex moral cinema. You weren't supposed to have movies that ridiculed the church or religion, or movies with interracial or same-sex romance. But there was a time before this code was implemented, before it started to be strictly enforced in around 1934, and that brief period between the spread of talkies, so movies with synchronized sound, which was mainly in 1929, and then the stricter enforcement of the code in 1934, that like 5-year period is known as the pre-code period in American film. And it's characterized by movies that experimented with more controversial content of multiple kinds. So you had salacious content in terms of sex and violence and crime, the normal R-rated kind of stuff that shocks the morals. But it was also, I think is worth pointing out, a period of increased experimentation with progressive social themes that would mostly fade from American movies in the following decades, only to reemerge in the 60s. So I think that's an interesting parallel, that in the same time you see this brief early flowering of kind of like racy R-rated content, you also see things that we would later think are like good social values that were prohibited at the time, and they were sort of struck down with the same stick in 34.
Yeah, it's interesting too when you think about the film output, the cinematic output, as an indicator of what the underlying culture is or was, you know? Mm-hmm. Because once you have the code in place, yeah, to a certain extent, the code is a product of the culture, and therefore you can see those films that come out of it as a reflection of what the culture wanted to see itself as. But it also means you have this inauthentic view of what was actually going on in the zeitgeist of the time, you know? Let's go back when we watch films from the 1950s, American mainstream films from the 50s, and you get this kind of vision that's like, oh, wow, it looks pretty dry, and you know, it's pretty square. I don't know. It's very sanitized in many respects.
Well, people often hearken back to, they say there was a time where movies were more innocent. Have you ever heard that? There was a more innocent age in cinema, which I think is a horrible way of putting it. I mean, that's not really what it was. What you're saying is there was a time when American movies were more censored.
Right. Yeah. Because, I mean, it's certainly when you look at films from the 50s, there's plenty of horrible stuff going on, like socially, that's reflected in those films. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you have this code in place that's preventing this racier content from taking place. And it kind of limits the palette that artists of that time had to use, you know, that were at their disposal to bring their message across, be it like a really highly thought out artistic message or the B cinema message, which mm-hmm. I think, as we've discussed before, a lot of times B cinema, that is where in genre cinema, horror cinema, science fiction cinema, that's sometimes the first place where some of these cultural ideas are explored.
Yeah, totally. Before they reach the mainstream. Now, I don't want to. So we're going to be talking about this movie, Dr. X, which is a horror movie in the pre-code era. And for that reason, for its time and place, it does feel very weird and edgy and unlike movies, you know, horror movies that would be put out by American studios a decade later. It feels mm-hmm. much more dangerous than that. But at the same time, I don't want to imply that this movie particularly embodies any like at the time controversial progressive social themes that I can think of. I don't think it really does. I mean, it's just like a horror murder mystery movie. But it does have this harder edge from being in that early 30s period that I think serves it quite well.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just got a darker, weirder, more dangerous sensibility than stuff you would normally expect to see from movies of the 30s. Though then again, I would say, you know, there are some that are in the post-code era that rival it in certain ways. Like, I don't know, Mad Love, I think, is sort of on the same level.
Yeah.
But maybe we should give the elevator pitch for this movie. Okay, so what's Dr. X about?
Okay, so imagine yourself at a medical academy where absolutely every member of the faculty is a prime suspect in the cannibalistic moon killer slayings, like serial murders that are taking place at night during a full moon. Mm-hmm. So we meet up with this character, Dr. Xavier. We'll get into the various pronunciations. And he's heading up the academy. The police have come to him and they say, hey, we think the killer is one of you guys. And the doctor, Dr. X here, says, give me 48 hours. I'll find the killer myself so the police don't have to get involved and we don't have to get a lot of bad PR for the academy.
Yeah, it's a pretty great setup. Maybe we should hit that trailer audio.
We are all under suspicion of murder.
What?
Absurd. Ridiculous.
What imbecile thought that up?
I'm Lee Taylor of the Daily World.
Then you did it.
Me?
It was you who printed that horrible story of Father in this morning's paper.
Don't be afraid tonight. Be sure you keep your eyes closed and relax.
I'm laying $10 to a dime. It's another moon killer murder.
One of us may be a murderer. A murderer who killed by the light of a full moon, leaving his victim's body mutilated.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
Now, we may have buried one of the leads here, which is that this seedy 1932 horror movie about cannibalistic murders and synthetic flesh was directed by Michael Curtiz, the director of Casablanca. That's a pretty odd fact. So Michael Curtiz was a Hungarian-American film director who made a lot of the most well-regarded movies of Hollywood's golden age. He made The Adventures of Robin Hood in 1938 with Errol Flynn, of course, Casablanca in 42, Mildred Pierce in 1945. He did at least one James Cagney crime movie. So we are not dealing with a Roger Corman type here. This is not a scrappy schlock production, you know, for kids at the drive-in. This is one of the era's most high-profile and successful directors. But there are ways in which Curtiz, I think, was much like Corman. And one of those ways is that Curtiz was prolific, ferociously productive, and he put out a staggering volume of film work of sort of mixed staying power. Some of it, you know, is considered classics, movies like Casablanca. Other stuff is largely forgotten. And he bounced all over genres. He directed musicals, westerns, swashbucklers, horror movies, biblical epics. And another thing that's interesting about him is that basically everybody who chronicles his life points out that his personal habits took the idea of staying busy to an almost fanatical extreme. There's one example of this. It's a paragraph that I came across when I was reading an article in the LA Times by Kenneth Turin that was a review of a book called Michael Curtiz, A Life in Films by Alan K. Rode. And so Turin writes the following. Both on camera and off, Curtiz wanted things always to be moving. Hurtling cars and trains and propulsive people figure prominently in his films. Even the dark factory smoke in the movie Female moves purposefully across the screen rather than just evaporating lazily into thin air. Someone who is likely easily bored and reportedly needed only 4 hours sleep, Curtiz only wanted to be doing, 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 which led to difficult situations with his cast and crew. It's not just that the director believed lunch breaks were for wimps. Rode notes that Curtiz's, quote, demonic work ethic approached savagery, and working conditions on his sets are said to have been set are said to be one of the reasons that the Screen Actors Guild was formed.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, just a hyperactive filmmaker who just wanted to be working all the time and perhaps just did not understand that other human beings either could not do that or did not want that,
right,
as the defining energy of their life.
Yeah, there was a whole other thing I was reading about his war against lunch. Like, he hated lunch. He thought lunch was a stupid waste of time and that actors were lazy after lunch. And so he encouraged people to skip lunch because then they would be more productive in the afternoon. I don't know. It sounds borderline pathological.
You know, I have to say that I'm ultimately not super familiar with his work. I saw Casablanca once for a film class in college and enjoyed it. You know, it's an important film. But I've seen Overdrawn in the Memory Bank so many times and so many more times than Casablanca that the simulated Casablanca scenes in Overdrawn are the ones my mind goes to when I think of Casablanca. I think of Raul Julia,
right?
As
Rick.
Wait, what's the character?
It's not Rick. It's Fingal.
Yes, Fingal. I get Rick. Rick and Fingal are one in my mind.
Wait, who's Peter Lorre in Overdrawn in the Memory Bank?
They have some guy doing like a really, stereotypical Peter Lorre impersonation.
That's funny.
I don't remember if it's anybody connected to the plot.
Raul Julia was actually a good actor, and I bet he could have done a good Peter Lorre impression.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, he could have played every role in that film. But I mean, Raul Julia is great in that film. He's great in everything.
But I would say Curtiz's talent comes through in Dr. X. This is a movie that is busy. It moves. I mean, it's got a lot of action. It does not lag.
Yeah, there's not a lot of space to be bored in this film. Another thing about Curtiz, I don't know if you ran across this. This is an IMDb fact, so I don't know to what extent we can take this as absolute truth or if it's just a story about him. But supposedly he fell out of a moving vehicle once because he had some idea that he had to jot down. He had to write down on some notepad paper. He was driving the vehicle at the time.
That sounds about right.
So another interesting thing about this film is not interesting because of the names attached to it, but for what it tells you about various storytelling mediums of the time. This was based on a play by Howard Warren Comstock and Alan C. Miller. So back in the day when I guess you just had more genre plays, you could have a cannibalistic serial killer play that one might view.
Yeah, that's interesting. Today, if one goes out to see a play, it's almost certainly going to be either a classical play, it's like, you know, Greek or Shakespeare or something, or if it's a modern play, it's like a character-driven drama or it's a comedy. But we forget in the early 20th century, like genre plays in terms of like bloody, gory, horror productions for the stage were extremely common, like the Grand Guignol in Paris. I don't know. In a way, I miss this tradition. Like, why don't high school theater groups do viciously bloody Grand Guignol? I'm sure you can still get those scripts somewhere. They're probably even in the public domain.
Yeah, and they'd probably be pretty fun to put on.
You get some kids to do the special effects, all the eyeballs squirting out and stuff. I mean, that could be good.
Yeah. Well, let's get into some of the players in this picture.
Okay, well, you had an actor named Lee Tracy in one of the main roles in the movie. Now, Lee Tracy is not one of – he doesn't play any of the scientists. Instead, he plays Lee Taylor, who is sort of the everyman anchor for the story. He is a reporter for a newspaper called The Daily World. He is a streetwise, fast-talking newspaper hack. The kind of sardonic crime reporter character who appeared in a lot of movies of this era and then would later be – sort of imitated or parodied for nostalgic recreations, like the character of Alexander Knox in the Tim Burton Batman. You remember that guy?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Played by the airless guy.
Yeah, Robert Wool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that guy, I think, is supposed to be a throwback to this stock character from 30s and 40s movies.
Yeah, the instant a character like this walks on the screen, because they're like, hey, what you got there, partner? Well, let me talk to you about this murder that's happening all over the town. I'm afraid to go out at night because, you know, it has this whole rhythm, this cadence. It's an obvious trope. Mm-hmm. I will say that Lee Tracy is quite good in this role, though. And while it does contain all these elements of the trope, it seems to have some other fun quirks added to it as well. So not only is he this snappy newspaper man, but there's this whole thing where he seems to be a practical joke enthusiast who often forgets that he's wearing one of these handshake buzzers.
Yeah.
You know, where
it's like his wedding ring. He just forgets it's on there.
He just forgets it's on. And this gag actually works quite well in the picture and plays into the plot a bit. So I applaud that for making a trope that I'm instantly not interested in actually entertaining.
Yeah, I got to hand it to him for that as well. And Tracy, I mean, he is this role. I mean, it's just in his bones, you can tell.
Yeah, I read that he apparently played a lot of snappy newspaper men. There's an attributed quote I found on IMDb, quote, "I should have quit playing newspaper men after three or four parts in the movies, but the money kept coming in and I liked it."
He liked it. It almost sounds like a line his character would say in Dr. X.
Yeah, I should have done it in his voice, but I can't do that voice too often.
Okay, so then the next major player you've got is Lionel Atwill, who plays a doctor. Oh, my God. So they pronounce his name like five different ways in this movie. It is like Professor Charles Xavier. It's Xavier mm-hmm. or Xavier is how I think most Americans would say it today. But in the movie, they call him Dr. Xavier. They call him Dr. Xavier. I don't know how many different ways they say it.
And then, of course, he is the titular Dr. X. Mm-hmm. But then, yes. In a way, the title also has another meaning, which we'll get to, and that is Dr. X is in Dr. Unknown.
Right, yes.
So Atwill is one of these actors who played a ton of characters who were either inspectors or doctors. Mm-hmm. In this, he gets to play both. He's a doctor who acts as an inspector. And sometimes he played villains as well, such as the role of Moriarty in Sherlock Holmes and the Secret Weapon from 1943. And he was also in a string of horror films in the 1930s. He played the one-armed Inspector Krog in Son of Frankenstein in 1939, which I believe was later parodied in... what is it? The Mel Brooks film.
In Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, I believe they parody that role a bit in there.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, but in this, yes, he is a doctor who acts as an inspector. So he has a lot of screen time. He's just constantly talking.
Yeah, and he's got a little bit slightly off-brand Christopher Plummer vibes. You know, he's a little bit Christopher Plummer, but slightly less dashing.
Yes. And then there's also – he does have this quality, too, where you're not sure if you can trust him or not either. Like a lot of this film is centers around a whodunit scenario. And indeed, you don't know what Dr. X's deal is as well. Dr. Xavier's deal is.
Yeah, it's great. There's a cast of like seven different creeps who are all testifying to each other's integrity, but they're all just like the most ominous, menacing people you've ever seen.
Yeah, it's a real rogues gallery, this medical academy. We'll get it, mm-hmm. like, even without getting into the details of their
Let's
characters,
not spoil
which, we'll,
it, yeah.
which we'll get to. They all just look wonderful and grotesque in their own ways. It's a wonder. We're not going to list their name, the names of the actors, because most of those names are probably not going to really resonate with mm-hmm. listeners. They're worth looking up, though, if you're curious. But yeah, there's so many scenes where you'll have like our leading lady who we're about to get to, and she's talking like a foot away or less with one of these characters. And the lighting between the two characters is so distinct because, of course, she is illuminated and beautiful like an angel.
Right.
And then these various character actors are illuminated in ways to like really bring out the rugged definition of their face and all the lines and make them look like hollow, gaunt, haunted skeletons. It's wonderful.
That's very well put. Well, we should get to the leading lady because she, I think, is without a doubt the most well-known member of the cast here. It's Fay Wray. Fay Wray plays...
That's right.
Joan Xavier, the daughter, I think the daughter. Yeah, the daughter of Dr.
Yeah, the daughter.
X, Dr. Xavier.
I wasn't clear on that for about half the picture. But
yeah,
it is,
same here.
She's the daughter.
Yeah. And I mean, God, it's Fay Wray from King Kong.
That's right. One of the original Scream Queens. She played Ann Darrow in the 1933 film King Kong. So she hadn't like fully exploded. Like King Kong was the film that really launched her into the spotlight in a major way. Mm-hmm. But she had a very long career. So she was born in Canada, but raised in Hollywood. So she entered acting at an early age, at 16, I believe, in the 1923 short Gasoline Love. She acted in 123 titles up through 1980. And as for standout roles, she was in 1932's The Most Dangerous Game. And a standout role for us anyway would also be Mystery of the Wax Museum from 1933, which we've mentioned on Stuff to Blow Your Mind before. She was in The Vampire Bat in 1933. And she's a legend. There, you can't deny her. In fact, she is mentioned twice in the lyrics to the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Oh,
so there's there's a whole bit at the start of one of the songs. Whatever happened to Fay Wray? That delicate satin draped frame as it clung to her thigh. How I started to cry because I wanted to be dressed just the same.
Does Dr. Frankenfurter sing that?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
That's one of the closing songs there. Mm-hmm. But she's also mentioned in the lyrics to the opening number, Science Fiction Double Feature, as is this very movie, by the way.
Dr. X?
Dr. X. There's the chorus. Yeah. Where it goes, Science Fiction Double Feature, Dr. X will build a creature.
Very nice.
That's my riff-raff. So anyway, yeah, like, you know, Fay Wray, Hollywood icon, and Dr. X in its own way is also part of the legacy of genre filmmaking here. So I've been hearing Dr. X all this time, watching and listening to Rocky Horror Picture Show, and I never really looked up what that was, but it's clearly a reference to this film.
It almost sounds like it could be just a stock character reference. Like it wouldn't have to be a real character from something.
Yeah, because it sounds like a stock character, Dr. X. Mm-hmm. You know, he's clearly a mad scientist of some sort, right?
Right. Now, there's another strange feature of this movie that I wanted to mention, which is that this is 1932, but the movie is sort of in color. It was made via a process that they were trying to get going at the time called two-color Technicolor. It's sort of a strange technical interlude in the history of film. The movie is not exactly in full color. There are a lot of hues that don't get captured. You're not going to get accurate purples and blues and yellows and all that. But it's definitely not in black and white, though there was an alternate version of the film that was shot in black and white. I've read that it's almost identical in content, except for some minor changes to ad-libs and the dialogue. But there are two versions of this movie that were shot, one for black and white projectors and one for the Technicolor version. And this, I think, was the product of a deal between Technicolor and Warner Brothers. Apparently, Technicolor was not happy with the fact that an alternate black and white version of the film was produced. So it's kind of hard to describe exactly how it looks, but it's sort of in color. Certain types of colors and shades come through. The dominant ranges of the movie seem to be sort of like green and orange. And I think that's because the two color process used two filters. One was green and one was red. And I would say this two color spectrum would not be a good fit for every film. But I feel like it sort of works in this one. It's kind of appropriate because it suggests this diseased world of orange light that's kind of shining through the glass of a beer bottle, but also with this atmosphere of green fog. It works for Dr. X.
Yeah, it kind of has this dope fiend vibe to it, which is fitting because there is a quote unquote dope fiend at one point in this film.
Another thing that you wouldn't get with the code.
Yeah. So I agree. I think it absolutely works here. If you run across a black and white copy of this film, don't watch it. Watch the Technicolor one, because if black and white is the spectrum of truth and art for filmmaking of the time, then it feels appropriate that we have this alternate unreality of Technicolor in this film. Plus, there are elements of the flesh, of the synthetic flesh, that I think really pop well with the color. Like I imagine they would have been equally creepy in some respects in black and white, but the color, ooh, it really makes it work.
I agree, and especially because it's such an unnatural color schema.
Yeah.
But by the way, if you want more information on the two-color process, the George Eastman Museum has a video I found. You can find it on YouTube that explains the technical details of the process. And one of the things that video points out is that the physical characteristics of the two-color film made it especially prone to scratching. And as soon as I saw that, I was like, because Dr. X, at least the version that I streamed, is full of scratches, long lines running vertically across the frame for whole scenes.
Yeah, same here. I streamed it through iTunes, I believe, and same situation. But I like it. I like seeing those flaws in it, you know, especially for a film from this period.
Totally.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend? Or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Okay, well, are you ready to get into the full plot breakdown?
Let's do it.
All right, so we start with title and credits, and then we open on a kind of seedy wharf. There's a tugboat floating in the background, and a policeman strolls by whistling in the dark. And it's revealed that we're out in front of a building with the sign that reads the Mott Street Morgue. And then there's a man in a long coat and a fedora skulking around outside. He's kind of hiding behind some barrels. He's smoking a cigarette. And then he looks up at the sky and sees a full moon and I think burns himself with his cigarette match. And he says, "Are you bad luck?" I guess talking to the moon. And it turns out that this is our hero in a way. Lee Taylor, played by Lee Tracy, the crime reporter. And bad luck is sort of his catchphrase. He says it like 8 times in the movie. Mm-hmm. And he is down here at the Mott Street Morgue because he's trying to chase down a grisly lead. There have been a string of horrifying murders in the city in recent months. I think it's supposed to be in New York City. I'm not quite sure, but was that the impression you got?
I just got the sense of it being the city, you know, yeah. That the sort of eternal cinematic city that could be any major metropolis of the day.
It's Dark City.
Yeah, basically Dark City.
But so these murders apparently all take place on the night of the full moon, and there's a full moon tonight. So while he's hanging out outside the morgue, authorities are bringing a body in, and Taylor thinks it might be another victim of the dreaded moon killer. Now, there's an entourage that goes into the morgue. It's a bunch of cops, and then it's this one guy in a coat with super silky fur lapels. And I think that's Dr. X that's going in there. But it's funny because he's folding these fur lapels under his chin while he's entering the building. And he looks like Cruella de Vil.
Yeah, they all have a very suspicious, villainous look to them.
Yeah. So Taylor tries to get into the morgue, but they won't let him in. And then he goes down the street, apparently to a brothel. I think that's what that's supposed to be.
Yeah, I think so, where he uses the telephone.
Mm-hmm. He makes a phone call to the night desk at his paper, the Daily World, and he's out here complaining. He's like, I can't get any dope. And the guy at the night desk is not very interested. And then he says to the editor here, he goes, listen, you lunkhead, I'm not clowning. Look out the window, will ya? And so the guy at the night desk looks out the window, and it's a full moon. And, I think then he gets it. He thinks, it may be another moon killer murder. And so the night desk editor is impressed by this, and he's like, okay, see what you can dig up. And so then Lee Taylor goes around trying to get some leads. He tries to chat up a beat cop to see if he can get any info. And in the course of their conversation, Taylor is, as we said earlier, revealed to be kind of a prankster because he zaps the cop with a hand buzzer, which is not a good idea.
No, I mean, luckily this cop is like the roundest. This is the softest cop you've ever seen in your life in this picture.
He's a sweetheart.
Yeah.
After they're chatting, he gives Taylor a cigar. He's like, here, some guy gave me this. You know, you can have it. I think maybe Taylor asks him for a smoke or something, but he gives him the cigar.
Yeah.
And then we cut to inside the morgue, and then things start getting really interesting because here is an autopsy scene. And Rob, I know you love a good autopsy scene.
I do. And this one kicks it off right.
So Dr. Xavier is examining the victim's body while the police detectives look on. And there's this great shot of the doctor's silhouette behind a raised shroud. Like, so they're lifting it up off the body and you just see him as a shadow operating behind it. But with his reflector on top of his head and everything, it looks kind of like horns or something. And so the police ask him, what's your theory, doctor? And he says, it's strangulation by terrifically powerful hands. And then they ask him about, well, what do you think of this incision at the base of the brain? And Dr. X says, obviously made by some type of scalpel used for brain dissecting. The word scalpel is said like that multiple times. So that's already shocking, right? Strangulation and an incision at the base of the brain, whatever that's supposed to mean. But then, here we get a but wait, there's more moment. The left deltoid muscle is missing from the victim. And one of the cops asks, it was torn right out? And Dr. X says, it wasn't torn. Gentlemen, this is cannibalism. I don't know. How can he tell that? Like, were there teeth marks?
Yeah, he doesn't say that there are teeth marks or that it looks like it was chewed out. He doesn't go into detail and say, well, this is a traditional like butchering cut or something. Like, nope, I just can tell this is cannibalism. And it's firmly established and not questioned.
It's the chuck portion of the human.
Yeah.
Here we establish the moon killer's MO. Strangulation by terrifically powerful hands, incision by scalpel at the base of the brain, and then eating the victim's left shoulder. And it makes me think this is a really overachieving serial killer. Like, they're trying to get extra credit.
Yeah, but it stands out, you know? It's like I'm instantly, I watch this and I hear this and I think to myself, well, I haven't come across this exact combination before. We're in fresh territory with this picture.
I agree. So they say this is the sixth murder in a row, all committed during a full moon by means of strangulation and incision with a strange surgical knife. So why is the killer doing this? The police want to know. And then Dr. X gets into some brilliant speculation. He says the killer is, quote, a neurotic, of course, some poor devil suffering from a fixation, a knot or kink tied in the brain from some past experience. And then he says that that a bout of madness comes on for the killer whenever he's confronted with a vivid reminder of the past. And the policeman is skeptical, but Dr. X insists. He says, I tell you that locked in each human skull is a little world all its own. And so the police want to know, well, what's the reminder? What's the thing that's triggering the killer to do this? And Dr. X says, it could be anything, the sight of the sea, the full moon. Every time he sees it, he's forced to relive the original moment that drove him mad.
Now, this is great, too, because we learned that this is Dr. X's specialty. This is his area of study. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, this is tied into his hypothesis for the murders. It's the same way, you know, if Terrence McKenna had been called upon to inspect these murders, he would have said, I believe it probably had something to do with psychedelic mushrooms.
Yep. Very good comparison. So anyway, Dr. X has given his professional opinion. He's about to leave. But then the police flip the script on him. Turns out they were sort of entrapping him here. All of the murders, they reveal, have taken place just in the vicinity of his medical academy. And what's more, the strange incisions made on the victims at the base of the brain have been traced to a special Austrian scalpel that is only in the possession of Dr. Xavier's facilities. So the medical supply companies confirm that no one else in the country has a knife like this. It seems like it would be hard to determine that, but that's what they say. And at first, Dr. Xavier is indignant and offended. He says his students and faculty are exclusively of the highest integrity. This is impossible.
Yeah. So again, we find out that the murderer is definitely somebody at the academy. Mm-hmm. But then as we begin to meet the members of the academy, we will learn, and we'll get into the details here, everybody is highly suspect and has ties to cannibalism or the study of cannibalism or some other element. So it's wonderfully put together. Like, you can imagine a spreadsheet, and you're like, okay, everybody checks off like two things on this list. There's no real standout candidate here.
Yeah, it's like you imagine hiring at this medical academy. It involves, like, you know, must have 5 years of experience, must have eaten a human. But Professor X offers a compromise. He says, look, don't you investigate the people in my academy. Let me investigate my academy in my own way. And the detectives want to know then. They're like, well, how would you catch the killer? And then I had to write down Dr. X's response, because I thought it was great. He says, by immediately studying the pathological reactions of every man placed under suspicion, then trap the guilty one by a brain examination.
Science.
Oh, there is so much science exclamation point in this movie. There is an awful lot of very funny, implausible technobabble and scientific words being used in a context that makes no sense.
Yeah, if you watch this film, I advise you to not try and think too hard about anything sciencey that any characters say, because none of it really adds up. It'll just hurt your brain if you try and make sense of it.
Yeah. So anyway, Dr. X and the detectives agree. You know, Dr. X will investigate the people in his academy on his own. There will be no publicity. The press cannot know. And then after they leave the room, one of the sheet-draped corpses in the morgue suddenly sits up. Is it someone who has risen from the dead? No, it's old Lee Taylor, the fast-talking reporter. He's been snooping disguised as a cadaver. He's even got a little tag on his toe.
He's just so scrappy. He can't keep him away from the story.
Yeah.
Now, I have to say, I think this is all a pretty fun setup with the whole situation where Xavier is given the chance to solve this internally before the authorities move in. Because weirdly, having just watched the latest TV adaptation of The Name of the Rose, this is essentially the same predicament that Brother William finds himself in The Name of the Rose. Solve the murders in the Abbey internally before the papal inquisitor Bernardo Gui shows up and makes a bigger to-do out of everything.
Right, right. Now, I will say Dr. X is no William of Baskerville, but but he's, I don't know, he's a clever guy, though. If I have any major criticism of Dr. X, it is that Dr. X is far too trusting. I mean, just like every creep and weirdo he comes across, he's like, he couldn't possibly have done anything bad.
Yes, he ate human flesh once, not twice, tops, but he has a good heart. I trust him completely. He writes poetry in his spare time, for God's sake.
Yeah, that actually happens. So we'll get to that. So we follow Xavier and the detective. I'm sorry, I keep saying it different ways. I'll just say Dr. X the rest of the time. I'll probably fail at that, too. But we follow Dr. X and the detectives to his surgical academy, and we begin to meet the other characters. Now, first we meet Joanne or Joan, a character. Characters call her both names, and she is Dr. X's daughter. This is Fay Wray here.
Yeah.
but she doesn't appear to be a suspect. So the police are interested in meeting some of the suspects, and they want to interview these other faculty members. So first up is Dr. Wells, and it just happens to turn out Dr. X mentions, oh, well, he is a student of cannibalism. He's written a book about cannibalism, and this gets the attention of the police. And then when they go to interview him, he's hunched over a lab table with a jar containing a beating heart. And then he claims that he has kept this heart alive for 3 years through the power of electrolysis. I do not think that is a correct use of the word, whatever they had in mind. I think electrolysis is the decomposition of chemical compounds by the application of electric current. I'm not sure how that would keep a heart alive.
Yeah. Again, don't think too much about anything sciencey that's brought up in this film.
Okay. I apologize.
It's generally said in a very nice British accent, so just accept it.
I got to say, in a weird way, like, Dr. Wells has a creepy vibe, but he's also kind of a hunk. Like, he's got wild hair and a 5 o'clock shadow and kind of a deep voice. And I don't know if this is ever remarked upon again. I'm not sure what this meant, but there's a pair of boots in the corner of the room that are bubbling as if they have been dipped in toxic goop. And the detectives just kind of look at them and notice them. And then I don't recall
that
ever.
They're on a radiator. That's what they're doing. Yeah. So I couldn't figure out. I was like, are there boots melting on the radiator? I wasn't sure what was happening there.
Yeah, I don't think that ever came up again, or if it did, I didn't notice it.
But it looked nice. It looked nice.
But anyway, it is soon revealed that Wells could not possibly be the murderer because, remember, the murderer strangles with two ferociously powerful hands, and in fact, Wells is an amputee, and he wears a prosthetic left hand, so he is not capable of having performed the murders, so the police exclude him at the beginning.
Luckily, though, there is an entire faculty of really suspicious characters to turn to next.
Right. Next, we meet this guy named Haynes. The police want to know something about him. And so they ask Dr. X, yeah, tell us about this Haynes guy. And Dr. X, I just have to reproduce this speech. He says, Dr. Haynes and two other scientists were shipwrecked off Tahiti about a year ago while making a study of the coral reefs for the Killery Foundation. They were adrift for 24 days. Their supplies were exhausted. When they were picked up, Haynes and one other were delirious. The third had vanished. There was no explanation at the time. Haynes later claimed at the time that the man had died and had been thrown overboard. So again, it's like it's as if this surgical college only hires people who have been suspected of cannibalism. But Dr. X says, you know, he's sure that Haynes cannot be the guilty party because this is his reasoning. One, the killer is a maniac. And two, Dr. Haynes is one of the most brilliant men in the medical world. So see, it's impossible. So they go to meet Dr. Haynes, who is experimenting with new procedures in what he calls brain grafting. I tried to look that up to see if that's really a thing. And no, I think that would just mean like a brain transplant, which has never been performed in humans.
Yeah, never been possible. Yeah.
But it
sounds plenty suspicious. Like, he definitely has his toes in the mad science.
Sure.
As does Wells with the beating heart.
How would you characterize Haynes' personality? I would say that he is paranoid. Like, he is not pleased to have the police in his lab. And while they're poking around, they find a kind of I couldn't tell exactly what it was. It looked like they found a kind of risque magazine among his things. It's like Ankles Quarterly. And in the police's eyes, this seemed to implicate him for some reason. It's like, oh, this guy likes, you know, risque magazines. You know who else does? Moon killers.
Okay, so another strong candidate, but there are more.
Yeah, and we're about to get to maybe my favorite guy in the movie. So next up, we meet Dr. Rowitz and Dr. Duke. Now, Rowitz is a tall, ominous man in a white lab coat with what I at first thought was an eye patch, but actually I think it is more like a dark-tinted monocle. So it's like sunglasses, but only one side of them. And when they first meet him, he's smoking a cigarette and leaning over a globe, and we find out that he studies the moon and is obsessed with the effects of lunar rays on neurotic types.
See, it's like a board game, this picture. I love it how all of them have these just highly suspicious elements. They're not just a little suspicious. They're all very suspicious.
Yes. And I got to say, Dr. Rowitz is a god. I love Dr. Rowitz. He's like, I want to be buds with him.
Yeah, he's great. Though in a way, he's almost too suspicious. You like you kind of get the idea this couldn't possibly be the guy because he picked far too many items out of the villain accessory grab bag, right?
Yeah, I agree. But then we meet the other guy. We meet Dr. Duke, who his main personality traits are that he is ornery and irascible. He just complains about everything. So he uses his wheelchair and he comes into the lab yelling at the detectives. They like ask him how he's doing and he yells at them for asking him how he's doing. He's just always mad about something.
There are elements of this character that remind me of Dr. Everett V. Scott in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Mm-hmm. So I would not be surprised if there was a connection there. I have nothing to go on other than Dr. X is mentioned in the lyrics and therefore might have been in the mind of Richard O'Brien when he wrote the thing.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and I almost forgot to mention that we learn Dr. Rowitz was also in the lifeboat with Dr. Haynes. So it was the two of them and the third delicious man who disappeared and was, quote, thrown overboard. It's funny how it's like it's as if the rowboat story only applies to Haynes and does not apply to Rowitz. I'm not sure why, even though they say he was the other guy in the boat. But they start grilling Rowitz about his moon research. And Rowitz says, if you suffer sunstroke, might you not suffer some similar evil from the rays of the moon? And the cop says, moonstroke, you mean? and Rowitz says, you know, the moon is powerful. It lifts billions of tons of water twice a day. I guess he's talking about the tides. And then he compares the water lifting to what is done by an old scrub woman, which is notable to the police because the last victim of the moon killer was, the papers called her an old scrub woman. I think the paper headline you see is like old scrub woman killed by moon killer.
It's great. The script is just so well put together.
Yeah. Now, the police suspect Rowitz again. Like every new guy they meet, they're like, oh, it's got to be him. It's like that scene in Murder on the Orient Express where like every time they interview somebody, the companion's like, that's the one. They did it. But so the cops are like that. But Dr. X is like, no, Rowitz can't be the murderer because here's his reasoning here. He has a lovely nature and he's the author of several volumes of poetry. I mean, who's ever heard of a poet killing somebody?
Yeah, that doesn't seem very logical. So this is definitely an area where he's falling below the Sherlock and Brother William threshold.
I would agree. So it looks like we've met our suspects and the mystery investigation is afoot. And Dr. X promises that he will complete this investigation within 48 hours. And then meanwhile, you get some side story with Taylor, the newspaper man, and Faye Ray meeting up when she catches him snooping around on the fire escape outside the medical academy. She confronts him and then shoves a revolver in his belly. He tries to get some facts out of her, but she rebuffs him. Joan Xavier clearly wants nothing to do with Mr. Hot Scoop. Like he thinks he's very cool and he thinks he can sweet talk her, but she just wants none of it.
Right. And she's more concerned about her father because he seems overworked.
Right. Yes. She's concerned about his health. She says several times, I think, just because like he never gets any rest. There's also, I guess we could just throw in, we meet more creeps. The movie's just crawling with creeps. There's a scene where we meet this guy named Otto, who is Xavier's butler. And he's just another one of these ominous weirdos to round out the cast.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, just a great cast of character actors in this film.
So then we get a scene that goes by pretty quickly, but I thought it was pretty good. So Taylor, the reporter, goes off to kind of kick rocks in the alley. Like he's upset because he can't get any good leads and he's moping around about his failure to crack the case. And then we get a very disturbing moment of suspense because behind Taylor's back, we see emerge a grotesque figure in a hooded cape with a drooping, sagging, almost melted sort of face. And it approaches Taylor from behind to strangle him just as he's lighting a cigar, the cigar that he received as a gift from his cop friend earlier. And just as the creature is about to grasp his neck, you get this pop and it's a trick cigar. It explodes, scaring away the moon killer in the process. And Taylor never knows his life was saved by a prank.
Yeah, it's a great little scene because it's suspenseful. It gives us our first very effective glimpse at the murderer, the monster in this film. But then also it redeems that whole ridiculous scene with the cop earlier. Again, this at first glance, this script might seem kind of schlocky, but it's so economical in the way everything ties together. Like everything has a purpose.
Yeah, it is very tight. So Taylor keeps snooping. He goes by Xavier's house and meets a gullible maid named Mamie who lets him inside. And he tries to steal a photo of Dr. X and a photo of Fay Wray. And she catches him in the act and chews him out for writing a negative story about them and throws him out of the house. And then after this, we get a shift. The action retreats to a new location. So everything moves to Dr. X's country estate on Long Island, and he gathers all the various creeps from the academy there, and he informs them that he has to perform an experiment to determine whether any of them is guilty of murder. And I don't recall it being established how he figures out to go here, but Mr. Hot Scoop also shows up. You know, our reporter hero finds his way out to the estate. He climbs up a drain pipe and sort of breaks into the house to continue snooping around and trespassing as the plot develops. And here there is a scene where I think basically anybody will recognize the following sequence that goes on with the reporter because it's recreated so many times in other movies and TV shows, where a character is nervously sneaking around in the dark and then is startled by a string of loud noises, but all caused by inanimate objects, like an ironing board falls out of the wall, then a cuckoo clock starts chiming, and then Otto the butler walks by carrying a skeleton for some reason. For the next 10 minutes or so, there is a lot of Lee Tracy making wisecracks at inanimate objects, like telling a skeleton to cut it out, will ya?
Yeah. Yeah, it gets very stoogey there for a minute.
But anyway, this is all working up to one of the big set pieces of the film, which is Dr. X's experiment to determine who the killer is. I guess how would it be best to set this up and describe it?
Well, I would summarize by saying this is basically sci-fi Shakespeare. This is Hamlet. This is the play is the thing.
Right.
Because that's essentially what the whole scheme is. I'm going to show something to them, and then based on their reactions, I will know.
Yeah, like if you were hooking the king up to an electrode and a machine that would read his guilt as he watches mm-hmm. the play. Yeah.
Yeah. And if it were elaborate. It took some explaining
right.
and had lots of tubes and liquids.
Right. So it's, at this point, it seems like the three main suspects are Rowitz, Haynes, and Duke. And they are strapped to electrical detectors that are supposed to measure their heart rate, maybe. I mean, there is just some magnificent technobabble about how the machine works. For some reason, it will measure the person in the machine for a history of cannibalism, and all three of them are going to go into they're going to get hooked up to the machine. And since Dr. Wells could not be the killer because he does not have the two ferociously strong hands necessary for the strangulation, he helps Dr. X administer the test on the three others. And there's this great part where Dr. Duke complains about being able to see the moon through the window. He's like, close the shutters. It's giving me a shiver. And
again, it's wonderful. They keep the potential guilt, the suspicion, just leveled out among all the candidates.
Yes, yes. Well, and so they've got different attitudes. Like Dr. Duke is complaining just because he's always complaining. He's just always mm-hmm. mad about something. Dr. Haynes, again, is quite paranoid. He's very against the whole situation. He feels his privacy is being invaded and he's nervous about something. And he says, if you ask me, Dr. Xavier, that's how he says it this time, Dr. Xavier is using very unethical methods. And then Rowitz, who of everybody is the most on board with the whole experiment, he just responds, necessity has no ethics.
Yeah, he's straight up like, I celebrate the chance to prove my innocence. Bring on the ridiculous mad science.
Yeah, but I think it's great because he might as well have just said, like, the ends justify the means.
Yeah.
So the stimulus for the test, they're hooked up to this machine that's going to test them for cannibalism via their heart rate. And the stimulus for the test is going to consist of them looking at wax figures of the victims of the Moon Killer murders. I don't recall them explaining how these wax figures were made, where they came from. And just I think
beautifully created. I must have commissioned them.
Yes. And I think it's also it's worth noting that. So this was 1932. Michael Curtiz, the director, also directed a wax horror movie right around the same time that came out in 33. I wonder if he was double dipping with the prop department.
He may have. I haven't seen Mystery of the Wax Museum from 33, but yeah, it was. He also directed that. It was also in two-color Technicolor. I think these were the two of the last films that came out in that. Mm-hmm. But then it also starred Atwell and Fay Wray. So there you go. He was double dipping in multiple ways, I guess.
Interesting. So there's a reenactment of the most recent murder. So after looking at the wax figurines, there's going to be a reenactment of the murder, and it's going to be put on by Otto and Mamie, the butler and the maid. And this, for some reason, should reveal who the killer is via the machine. And just as the reenactment is about to reveal the killer, suddenly everything, we get the lights go out. You know, there's like a power outage and all hell breaks loose. So a bunch of stuff happens while the lights are out. Somebody's cannibalism detector device goes off. And then Dr. X reads it and declares, it's Dr. Rowitz. But there's a twist. When the lights come up, Dr. Rowitz is dead. So Rowitz has been murdered. And also suddenly Dr. Duke can walk again. He's up walking around.
Yeah.
And Dr. Haynes points him out and he's like, faker. And then we also find out Dr. Wells, who was helping administer the experiment, has been struck on the head by somebody in the dark who called his name and then hit him. And yeah, there's this part where Fay Wray quite rightly observes that this experiment was a disaster. And then everybody's just like, nah, chill out, calm down. you know, they're basically just like, don't worry about it. You know, you go get some rest. We'll deal with this dead body and everything. And then other, like a bunch of stuff happens all at once. So while all this is happening, Taylor, who is hiding out in the closet, snooping around, he gets gassed. Like somebody pumps some smoke into the closet with him and it knocks him mm-hmm. unconscious, and you don't know who did it. And then they discover him unconscious in the closet, but they decide to let him stay for the night at the manor. I'm not sure why that is. But after that follows some incredibly implausible flirting between Mr. Hot Scoop and Fay Wray. Suddenly she's just responding to his flirting, whereas she hadn't been earlier. But anyway, everybody goes to bed, and I can't, did you notice, like, do they explicitly say, like, no, we're not going to report Dr. Rowitz's death to the police? It seems like they just decide that they shouldn't do that.
No, I mean, I think they decided we have to do a follow-up experiment.
Yeah.
We can't stop now. We're close. Because, I mean, it's basically what happened is, you know, you're like you're saying, they're sort of testing to see who was stimulated the most by these the stimuli they were presented with.
Right.
But then unfortunately, the individual who was stimulated the most, according to the readings, is also now dead, was killed in the dark. So it must be someone else.
That's funny, because that should indicate the fallibility of their experimental method, right? Like if he wasn't the murderer and yet he was the person that the test identified, that should show that the test is not necessarily great.
I agree. but yet they persist, you know, because ultimately he's thinking about publication. You know, it's not about whether you catch the murder. It's that you well document your attempts to catch the murder.
He's trying to get tenure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then also we just get the little tidbit that later that night, like Fay Wray is walking around and she comes across her father examining Rowitz's body under a sheet in a room in the house. And then we learn that his body has been cannibalized in the middle of the night. So somebody at the manor here cannibalized him.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
But yes, as you say, the murderer still has to be discovered, and this all leads to the second test. Before that, there is a scene of Hot Scoop and Fay Wray flirting some more. They're down at the beach. They're talking about swimming. There are some lines in this scene that are frankly hilarious. There's a great part where he's like, listen, forget that I'm a newspaper man. and I feel like here... I'm wondering if maybe we should sort of leave off in describing the plot in too much detail after this, because this is getting up to the climax, and I feel like we should at least be a little bit circumspect. But we don't want to spoil the mystery, do we? Though there's a thing that it's building up to that we have to talk about because it's the best thing about the movie.
Yeah, I think we basically have to have a werewolf break here in the episode. So we have to say, look, if you want to experience the wonderful twist for yourself, and we recommend you do, then you should stop listening to this episode now, go out and at your leisure, see the film for yourself, and then come back and you can listen to us talk about it, and then you can share your own thoughts on it, etc.
Okay, but if you're ready to hear the end right now, we absolutely must say that the revelation of the killer's identity involves the real star of this movie, and the best thing about it, a god mode plot device called synthetic flesh that even gets like it gets announced in a voiceover segment. There's like a voice that is not spoken by a character on screen. It just comes on the soundtrack saying synthetic flesh.
Yes. Yes. It's absolutely wonderful. And indeed it's a fabulous plot twist. And it really, I really got me too, because I have to admit, I was convinced that Dr. X had to be the villain. He's secretly the villain the whole time, and he made some sort of monster to do his bidding. And I believe this because that's what Richard O'Brien told me in the lyrics to Science Fiction Double Feature. He said, Dr. X made a creature. So I'm thinking that's it. That's clearly where we're going with this. Why would Richard O'Brien lie to me?
Right. Richard O'Brien wouldn't lie to you, but maybe he had just – it had been a while since he'd seen it. It got a little bit fuzzy. There is almost a sort of creature creation, but no. One of the parties there at the house is the villain, and it is revealed in a great sequence where – so all of the suspects, including Dr. X himself, are handcuffed to chairs so that they can't like get up and murder each other anymore during the second test. Dr. Wells handcuffs Haynes. Duke and Dr. X to these chairs, so they're held down. And then Dr. Wells reveals, I'm the killer. And they're like, well, how could it be you? And the answer is synthetic flesh. And we get this amazing psychedelic body horror sequence where it's very much I don't want to compare it too much to this because this came later, but it's kind of Clayface from Batman, where there is this putty that Dr. Wells applies to himself that I think is made from the flesh of the people who he supposedly cannibalized. And this putty goes on his body and can make new flesh and organs as he like smooths it on.
Yeah, it is fabulous. Another thing I would compare it to, and again, this is something that came later and I think was probably influenced by Dr. X, and that is Sam Raimi's Darkman.
Yes.
Because the main character in that, played by Liam Neeson, is a scientist who has created synthetic skin, which he kind of, you know, puts on. I forget if he gobs it on or he just kind of pulls it on like a mask. But at any rate, it's some sort of a fleshy goo that can transform his face into the face of another.
But yeah, the essential premise here is that you can like mold organs and skin out of this clay and just smear it onto your body, and then it becomes functioning tissue.
Yeah, so Wells, in this fantastic, lengthy, mostly dialogue-less scene, he puts on this synthetic flesh claw, this great monstrous hand that he attaches to where he suffered his amputation, and then he begins to gob this stuff onto his face, and it really turns the weirdness in this film up to 11. You have the strange, you know, two-tone Technicolor effects going on, and it really feels more in keeping with experimental cinema of later decades, you know, at least from a modern film going perspective. Again, there's no dialogue other than Wells saying synthetic flesh a couple of times.
But as I said, you don't see his mouth moving when he says it. It's like he says it as if like it's in his head, like it's a voiceover, and it repeats. And so it very much has the feeling of something that would be sampled in a techno song or something.
Yeah. I was thinking the same thing. It feels like something that would be sampled in a mix, and I hope has been sampled in a mix. DJs, if you're listening, sample this because it's wonderful. But also the background audio for this whole scene is just kind of like mad science-y electros. And I was absolutely digging this as I was watching and listening to it, because I think in many ways it's an accidental early electronic music score. Maybe something, it sounds like a little post-industrial, like something like Nurse with Wound would have created. In fact, I would love it if we could actually just listen to a sample, an audio sample from this scene, so you can get a taste for it. Synthetic flesh.
Amazing.
I want that. I want to pick up the single.
Yeah.
Just as a bit of score trivia, though, credit for the first electronic score generally goes to BB and Louis Baron for their work with a magnetic tape on 1956, the 1956 film Forbidden Planet. So this isn't an example of an electronic score, but if it were an electronic score, it would be way ahead of its time. I also have to say that that the sequence where he's smearing the synthetic flesh over his face and into his hair and forming this new face, this face of the Moon Killer. It reminds me a lot of the later, the modern performance art of French artist Oliver de Sagazin, who many of you may have seen. One of his performances features into the 2011 film Samsara, but you can also find clips of his work online. Just look for Oliver de Sagazin, S-A-G-A-Z-A-N, and you'll see what he does. Basically, he sets up in front of a camera, and then he layers paint and clay over his own face and does a fair amount of performance art with it to just transform himself into these various kind of monstrosities. There's an unsettling nature to his work, but it's wonderful. And in this film, in Dr. X, we kind of see a far earlier version of that same performance art.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me wonder, what are the other great examples of sort of extreme makeup effects in film from the 30s? I don't know of any other movies from this era that have effects that look like this. I mean, I would have thought, makeup at the time was all basically just like realistic accentuation of the face, not the kind of like horror movie makeup effects we associate with movies of the 70s and 80s.
Yeah. I mean, it's impressive. I'm trying to figure out what it, we can think about what it's supposed to be. You know, it's kind of like he's gobbing himself down with sci-fi stem cells or something, but, mm-hmm. Some sort of flesh that instantly forges a connection with his own flesh. But I imagine it's probably a twist on perceptions of elaborate special effects makeup of the day. You know, the putty is like flesh, and then it seems to become the flesh. And within the context of the film, I don't know, it's like he's got this big old jar of stem cells, and he's just gobbing it on and sculpting his flesh into the desired nightmare. But I think also we can find a possible connection here to sort of the zeitgeist of the time when you look back at the history of plastic surgery, which, to be clear, doesn't mean the use of plastic in sculpting flesh, but the overall plasticity of flesh that can be utilized in reconstructive surgery. So you look at some of the achievements that were made even at that time and in previous decades. And they were pretty amazing. Stuff like walking lengths of flesh up to the face or down from the forehead in order to slowly graft it and form it and to reform features that were lost. Cartilage implantation is another example. If you look up images of, say, World War I facial reconstruction, you can see examples of this because some of it is quite amazing. I mean, it can be a little tough to take in, but it's quite interesting. Remember, this is 1932, so memories of the First World War's injuries are still raw, as are likely the photographs of the surgical reconstructions that were possible. There's even a great line from Wells that I feel like reflects this, because as he's having his supervillain reveal speech, he says, "Yes, look at it, a real hand. It's alive. It's flesh, synthetic flesh. For years I've been searching to find the secret of a living manufactured flesh, and now I found it. You think I went to Africa to study cannibalism? I went there to get samples of the human flesh that the natives eat. Yes, that's what I needed, living flesh from humans for my experiments. What difference did it make if a few people had to die? Their flesh taught me how to manufacture arms, legs, faces that are human. I'll make a cripple world whole again."
So again, we get a very ends justify the means thing. It's like, look, I've had to kill a lot of people, but I'm going to create amazing new surgical techniques by what I've learned through doing so.
Yeah. And I think, you think about this film as coming out, post-World War I and before World War II. It seems like it seems like that may be what it's latching on to here. And again, this is kind of the territory. This is the area in which genre filmmaking often works.
I think this is probably also a time where people were trying to figure out the limits of what was ethical scientific experimentation. There was True. Probably a lot of experimentation going on that we would today regard as unethical in its nature, but was. It was not just people who were like, "I'm trying to do evil." It was people who had this idea of think of all the good that we could accomplish.
Exactly. Yeah. And just continuing to to roll with what these technological changes meant for humanity. You know, like suddenly we're able to wage war in ways that we were not able to previously. I mean, one of the prime examples from the First World War would, of course, be chemical weaponry. And we have a brief scene of chemical weaponry in this film as the newspaper guy Lee is gassed there.
You know, as for other ways that this movie fits into the history of science, there's a thing that comes up several times, which is forensic experimentation, or like forensic biometrics, basically using brain examination or heart rate monitoring or things like that to determine the guilt of a person in trying to solve a criminal case. If you would like more information about the history of that kind of thing, we did an episode. I actually was Christian and I did a couple of episodes several years ago about the failures of forensic science, where we talked about this big report that looked into the reliability of forensic sciences that are supposedly used to establish guilt in the courtroom, and how some of them are in most cases pretty solid, you know, like DNA evidence and all that. But a lot of them do not have as solid a scientific basis as is often represented, and may very well be sort of just sort of stealing the imprimatur of science as a concept to placed on some kind of weak evidence.
Yeah. Speaking of weak evidence, I do love that ultimately Dr. X was wrong, you know? Like earlier in the film, he's like, I'm totally sure that the killer sees the moon and it awakens these repressed feelings inside him. That is what I will look for. And that is not what was happening at all.
No, the killer was like Dr. X. It was a researcher who was fanatically dedicated to his own work and was trying to and was willing to do whatever he could to further it.
Yeah. So in a way, it would have been interesting to see where they would have gone with a sequel to this film, right? In that they could ask, well, where does Dr. X go from there? He's been kind of been proven wrong. In a way, he's in a similar place to where William of Baskerville is at the end of The Name of the Rose, where he realizes that to a certain extent, his logic and his reason has failed him. He wasn't able to actually prevent anything, even as he was able to solve the mystery.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, I hope that the Dr. X has learned his lesson and will no longer say that you can prove the guilt of someone suspected of murder by using a machine.
Yes, hopefully so. But I don't know. He seems rather stubborn, and he's already invested in all that gear.
Yeah. Oh, we didn't even say how it ends. I mean, so the other thing is after – so Wells is going to kill Fay Wray while they're all handcuffed to chairs. And then Lee, the reporter, is like, hey, this can't happen. And so he comes out and does it. He gives him the old fisticuffs and punches Wells in the face, and they fight. And then I think he kills him by throwing a lamp on him, which sets him on fire. And
yeah, well, he shoots him in the, hits him in the face with a lamp and then kind of like tackles him through a window.
Oh, I think he also hits him with his hand buzzer, doesn't he?
Possibly. Yeah, he is looking at his hand buzzer after it happens. So that may have played a role. It would make sense because, again, the script is very economical. And then we get a nice little spot of romance, and that's the end of the picture.
Yeah, that's it. Oh, we get what he calls his society editor on the newspaper. He's like, hey, you know, you might want to set aside some. What does he say? He's like, you might want to save some space for Dr. Xavier to make an announcement about his daughter, I guess, implying that they're going to have a wedding announcement or something.
Yeah. So you get your happy lovey-dovey ending. The ending, again, is very, very mainstream and normal.
Yeah.
The beginning is fairly normal. But man, the middle of this film gets into some serious weirdness, and I love it. So you might be wondering, where can you get this film? Well, you can rent or buy this one digitally most places. You know, wherever you get digital films, you can rent it or buy it. You can also pick it up on DVD, either as part of a two-movie pack, along with the 1939 sequel. There is an actual sequel to this. I doubt that it meets my expectations, but it's called The Return of Dr. X, which starred an up-and-coming actor by the name of Humphrey Bogart. I haven't seen it, but we have brought it up on the show before just because I believe it has a synthetic blood plot element.
I think I've read that it has little to do with this movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't imagine it is. It really carries on the legacy well. You can also pick this up in a big box set that also includes Mad Love and a few other films. So that's worth looking for as well. Man, imagine a Mad Love Dr. X mashup, though. That would have been something.
Oof, yeah. Now, one thing I will say that these movies have in common is that they're both, I think, pretty great sci-fi horror movies for their time. Both are sort of pushed over the edge into transcendence by one amazingly weird scene toward the end. In this case, it's the synthetic flesh scene. In Mad Love, it's the scene where he's dressed up as Orlac in the brace with the sunglasses and all that, that costume.
Now, yeah, the Rollo costume, yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry, not Orlac, the Rollo costume, you're right, yes. Those are like the scenes that make the movies in both cases. But whereas Mad Love has Peter Lorre, I don't think this movie has anybody of the Peter Lorre caliber in it.
No, I mean, you know, it's got a couple of big names for the time. Mm-hmm. And we mentioned you got Atwell and you got Fay Wray. But in terms of bringing the performance, like bringing something performance wise that's memorably weird, yeah, they don't really have it. I guess you get kind of sprinkles of it, though, with the supporting cast.
Yeah. Dr. Rowitz. Yeah, he doesn't have enough screen time, but he's my hero.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and put a scalpel in this one. And
a scalpel?
It's done. A scalpel in it and call it done. This has been another episode of Weird House Cinema. We're putting out Weird House Cinema every Friday. Stuff to Blow Your Mind remains a science and culture show, but Friday is our day to unwind a little bit and enjoy a little midnight movie goodness. So let us know what you thought. Did you see this film? Had you seen it previously? How do you feel about Dr. X? How do you feel about the twists and the turns and that crazy scene with the synthetic flesh? We would love to hear from you. Let's see, what else? Oh, yeah. Again, you can find this show in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. And we just ask that you rate, review, and subscribe. That's the main way to keep in touch with the show and keep up on what we're publishing.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest any topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Parrot Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.